Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. Today we'll be doing something a little different. Maybe Kenny can pick up the thread from here.
So I'll be asking the questions today. We are a month into the school year, and both of you are in the educational field. I think you both have a perspective that is important to share. And I'm curious as to, you know, what's happening. Like I said, it's been a month since the school year started in San Francisco. Many kids across the nation are back in school now. And I think in many ways, obviously, San Francisco represents the model of what is happening in other places. And so I guess, first of all, I would like to ask Andrew Lipson what his experience is with school. I mean, I remember that last year, towards the end of the year, right, you kind of coasted down to finish the year.
Yeah.
No one knew what was happening, what to do. But it seems like you had the summer to prepare for this, the school districts to implement plans and maybe give you training. So maybe if you can start with that as to what kind of training you got during the summer in order to execute the school year.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that while I'm in a public school and doing distance learning, 100% distance learning, Eduardo is teaching in a pod. And those are kind of two things that are in the news a lot, you know, pods. And so we thought it would be worth talking about our experiences. In terms of summer training, there really wasn't any. We didn't really even have a master schedule. A master schedule is basically knowing what classes you're teaching and when you're teaching them. We didn't really have a master schedule until a week before school was supposed to start. I still suspected that I was going to be teaching three 10th grade EL physics classes, that is English physics classes for English learners. Historically, it's been some Arabic students, some Filipino students, some Chinese students, but mostly Spanish speakers, my EL classes, and then two mainstream physics classes, and then what's something called an advisory. But it was up in the air. I didn't know what my schedule was until a week before school. So there were things like private companies were sending me stuff, do this PD, pay for this thing. But I didn't do any of those things, and I would have had to pay money. And I wasn't going to do them. Like, I don't agree with this distance learning thing. I don't agree with what we're going to. So in terms of preparation, there wasn't anything over the summer. On the week, the PD week, professional development week, just prior to school, there was one day where science educators would get together, and they had a 2-week curriculum that they wanted all science, high school science teachers to do. Like, literally, it was scripted. One, I think that was an awful idea, and two, there was no way I was going to do that. Like, there's no way, not even just professionally, but I can't. I've got to be able to feel like my curriculum. I've got to be able to like figure out why I'm doing what I'm doing. And that scripted curriculum just looked like a nightmare. And it looked impersonal, and it didn't look like something I would want to do with the students. And so I just came up with my own stuff and decided that, you know, we were going to start the first weeks basically creating our slideshows about ourselves so we can introduce ourselves.
You're talking about right now for distance learning through Zoom and okay.
Yeah. So, but you asked about the training. So I was just,
yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. I mean, how is it different in a regular pre-COVID year? I mean, what would be different during the summer?
During the summer, I would know more about what I'm going to try to do. And then I might be thinking, what's the one thing I'm going to change about my classes this year that I'm going to do different next year? Like, I don't generally make tons of changes. I usually choose one thing and I try to make that change and then introduce that into my next school year. This summer, I wasn't going to do that because I had no idea what I was expecting. And mostly I had just immense anxiety about the fact that I felt like this was going to be a kind of a soul killing experience. So I was really afraid. Like, I had a real tough time engaging in thinking about curriculum because I was mostly just afraid of what this experience was going to feel like being in front of kids in these Zoom monitored rooms, you know, class after class after class. So that's the only difference is I didn't really have any way of preparing for it because one, I don't agree with it. Two, I was afraid of it. And three, I had no idea what the experience was going to be like because you have to remember when I was going online with my students last year, I had already known them. They had come into my classroom. We got to know each other. And it was only the last 2 months that were Zoom. Now I was starting a whole class without any knowledge of virtually any of these students. And, you know, I've got about 115 students total, you know, in all my classes. I think it's about that number. And that's a lot of students to have no idea about. And it created a lot of anxiety for me to think what's this going to be like.
What about when you get to the, you know, you start the school year, first week. I mean, what anxieties have materialized? You know, what concerns do you think are there? Has anything changed, you know, in terms of your?
Well, the first thing that was difficult for me was to see what our daily schedule was going to be like. In the last time I was able to limit the amount of screen time for myself, in March, April and May last year, I was able to limit the amount of screen time for myself and I think for my students by combining my classes. And just we met in these combined classes instead of first period, second period, third period. Well, now we're basically going from computers, from classroom to classroom. That's what the student experience is, to go from classroom to classroom, first period, second period, third period, fourth period, fifth period, sixth period, seventh period, and have lunch somewhere in there. That might be their Monday. And then on Monday or on Tuesday and Wednesday, they've got a long first period and a long second period, a lunch, and then third period. And then that's a block schedule. So that goes from you're online from about 9 a.m. to around 2, plus advisory on Tuesday and Thursday. And then on Wednesday and Friday, you got a fourth period, a fifth period. Each of these classes is like 70 minutes. And you got a fourth period, fifth period, lunch, sixth period, seventh period. So you're just going from screen to screen to screen as a student. And as a teacher, you're just logging in, ending your, you know, getting everyone on a Zoom session, trying to do whatever you're doing in what is like, it's called synchronous learning, where everyone's in the same classroom. That's synchronous. The other one is asynchronous, where you basically say, look, here's an assignment, just go away and do the assignment. And that, you know, that's asynchronous learning. I do mostly synchronous stuff, and I'm not really that good and that comfortable with just giving asynchronous assignments when I haven't taught anything. So that's a lot of screen time for them. It's a lot of screen time for me. When I looked at that schedule, it was pretty like, I don't know. I was just like, this sucks. This just looks like, I felt two ways about it. One, I was really concerned about what students would experience going from class to class. I was concerned for myself. And in many ways, I felt like I got a vision of the future of education. That is, that we always talk about how education under capitalism is preparing you for the workplace under capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I actually believe logging on, logging off, logging on, logging off, and having this much screen time, I do believe is a preparation for the future work world that is being set up for these students. So I actually do believe that what they're experiencing right now is not just temporary, but is a preview of what education is going to be more like, but more importantly, what work is going to be more like. It's going to be grit and determination to be able to withstand hours and hours and hours of remote login time.
So I remember just backtracking a little bit to the end of the last school year, March, April, May. You mentioned some difficulties with the technical aspects and how it, you know, presented these challenges to just be able to connect. Has that changed? How has that impacted your ability to teach?
Well, I would say first I'll talk about the difficulties of teaching regardless of the technical aspects, and then we can get into the technical aspects. Let's say if you take my mainstream class of 24 students on my first period class, I think about 75% of those students show up, and all of those kids are just blank screens. Maybe they'll have a picture on their thing, but you're basically just looking at blank screens. You might say good morning. I say good morning. I say hi. Sometimes the kids will unmute themselves and say good morning. Sometimes they'll say good morning in chat, but at this time they've kind of gotten used to just being silent, because it's very frightening for them, and they're very afraid of engaging through this medium. It's not something that brings kids out of their shell. It's very individualized, and it keeps everyone in our own individual experience, and everyone's got whatever's going on at home. So I would say that's one thing I've seen. Number two is, I will do lessons and I will ask questions of people in class, but they generally, there's only a rare, like one student, maybe two students per class will unmute themselves to give a response. If I ask them to unmute themselves, most of the time they will. Sometimes they won't. Sometimes they will only either respond privately in chat, or they'll respond publicly in chat, say it to everyone or write it to everyone, or they won't say anything at all. And as a teacher, there's nothing I can do. I can't say, hey, unmute yourself. Like, you know, it's just, you just got to move on. So it's a very strange world we're in, like in this classroom, where they see me, I don't really see them. They respond mostly through chat, and it's very quiet. I think they're chatting with each other. Sometimes they're probably maybe they're playing Fortnite on another computer or on their phone. Could be, but I don't know what is happening because it's all blank screens. And then there's this notion that we could do breakout rooms and have them meet each other. But by and large, most students report it being pretty awkward in breakout rooms. They go to the breakout room and people are just quiet. Because again, that's the conditioning that's going on right now, is a conditioning of silence, of alienation. And there's a few things maybe we can do to try to break that down a bit. But I'll be honest, I think breakout rooms are not a solution for students getting to learn more about each other. And it's actually just a new way for them to be alienated, unless we figure out, and I don't even want to say figure out, there's nothing to figure it out here. This way of educating is supposed to kill our desire to be around each other and kill our desire to be educated and just basically turn us into drones. And it's doing it. I myself feel you asked me how I felt before we started this episode. Increasingly, I don't even feel depressed. I just feel flat. I feel like all the ups and downs that I go through emotionally are just being flattened out. And I think it's just waves hitting me. And I think the same thing might be happening to the students, but I really do believe it's happening to me. And I'm only in week four of the year. And this is, I got a long way to go.
Can you say a little bit about, you know, how attendance, I know we've talked about off camera, how, you know, from week one to week four now of the school year, how attendance has changed, you know, even though it's just blank screens, how, you know, there's.
I would say that it's been pretty stable. The technical aspects that I didn't really get to, like in some ways, that is seen more for the EL students, but I feel like attendance has been pretty much stable. 75 to 80% of my mainstream students showing up, and 50% of my EL students showing up. And it's with my EL students. I don't speak Spanish. I don't speak Mandarin, China, you know, Arabic, whatever, Cantonese. I don't speak any language other than English. And I've able in a classroom where they're trying to learn English, you can use physical prompts and you can see what they do to see what they're getting, what they're not getting. Here, I can't see them. And I really have no idea what they're understanding or what they're not understanding. And you know that students, and this is in my EL classes, you know that students are very, are not, there's a lot of students who are not very technical with things. You see them log in, log out. They'll go into a breakout room and come back and go back into a breakout room. It's just, they don't know what the heck's going on. You know, that's not for all of the students, but that's, there's a significant number of the people who are, of that 50% are showing up, at least 20 to 30% are really pretty lost with the technology. There is another, you know, 60% of those 50% who show up who are trying to make it and who have kind of are keeping up with what's going on. But things move extremely slow. And it's, I don't know, it has to be very painful for everyone. It's painful for me in my EL classes. It has to be painful for my students who want to move forward. It has to be painful for the students who are coming into class and have no idea what's going on. Then you have, we're starting to locate students and now they're coming into class and they have no idea what's happening because they've just been located by people at our Mission High School trying to find them and say, hey, are you going to come to school or not? And then now they're dropping in and dropping out and dropping in and dropping out. And it's, that is where for me, it feels like a Wild West show. And this is where like this notion that we talked about at the beginning of our school year of anti-racist teaching, you can't do anti-racist teaching under capitalism, but you definitely can't do like this whole method is built to exaggerate and expand racial divisions and the experience of racism, which already has made things worse for some people in this country. Now it's going to get that much worse. And that's going to be true for our immigrant kids. And it's going to be true for Black students, I think, are going to have a harder time under this medium, by and large. Not all of them, but by and large. And I think the divisions that already exist are only going to get worse. So it is not anti-racist to go into distance learning. It has never been safe to do this. So I guess that's sort of something. Maybe that you didn't ask about that, but that's something.
In previous episodes, we've discussed the attack on public education. So I was asking, you know, the previous question regarding attendance to kind of connect it, because I know in the past when I was in school, you know, the school would get money based on attendance.
Yeah.
You know, and so do you know if this has changed? Is the school district or the principal, the authorities at the school enforcing this? You know,
I don't know exactly what agreement Sacramento has with the rest of the school districts across the state, but I definitely get the sense that they're worried about what's called, you know, ADA money, which is the money you get for showing presence, the presence of a student in a class. And, you know, if a student sends me an email that says, hey, I can't make class, I'm supposed to mark that student present, you know, like that. If I get any sort of contact somewhere during the day, they're supposed to be present. And I know that there's a real nervousness about our attendance right now, because I do believe they think there's going to be an economic impact to that. But I can tell you that like already there are students who are getting essentially broken from this notion that there's a school that they're connected to called Mission High School. And its identity as a school is being eroded as we speak, as a sense of a place that, hey, this is where we go to learn or to get food or to meet our friends or to be part of a community. That has getting eroded quickly. And I imagine that is being repeated across the country at these places that were schools that people used to think of as centers of places where kids would come together to be part of sports or to be part of clubs and to meet each other, to do something social. That is being broken up And so I do believe that that's going to have an effect on public education, as well as the private companies who are making money off of teaching this, creating programs to essentially replace me.
Yeah. And do you get to connect with kids at all? Is there any kids that you can still, you know, somewhat have a conversation with?
Yeah. I mean, there are students I've seen a few times in office hours. There are students who, like, there was one student who had a Mortal Kombat icon. You know, that student has a Mortal, and I recognized it. And that student was into the fact that I recognized that it was Mortal Kombat, although it was Mortal Kombat 9, not Mortal Kombat 11. So we chatted a little bit, and, you know, I know that he's kind of likes the fact that I like that. I've had a few experiences like that with students. But overall, I feel very torn about what's going on. Like I don't want to bring students into this world, like into this world that we're creating. Like I'm not happy. I don't feel like I want to make this thing work. One, I don't think it can work. And two, I think it's a fool's errand. I feel like I'm drawing students into something that's only going to create a nightmare for them down the road. And so I really feel torn. Like there's some experience that I had in my EL class, in my seventh period class, where I saw students working together. And at one level, that's a good thing. But at another level, I'm really torn about, I don't think anything about this is good. So I have a tough time feeling good about things that are even what we would normally say are good things in education. So everything has poison in it for me. Every experience and every even good moments feels a little bit sour and poisoned because instead of feeling fully like I'm helping a student and reaching them, I also feel a little bit like a Pied Piper who is drawing them over a cliff. Even if I don't want to draw them over that cliff, as I draw them into this world of AI and data mining, I feel like I'm bringing them into a world that's a prison that's going to be constructed around them. So it's very difficult. I didn't have a lot of victories before when I was in public education, and now those moments are even fewer, and they have more poison in them for me. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious as to what other teachers are experiencing or, you know, communicating. Are you even able to connect with other teachers? You know, you've mentioned in the past that, you know, teachers have been moved out of their centers of power, you know, into this virtual cloud, you know, world. What are other teachers saying?
I mean, I know that other teachers are struggling. I think a lot of teachers, one thing I haven't tried to put a happy face on it, and I think a lot of teachers are trying to put a happy face on it and trying to, you know, give it the best face they can in these meetings and stuff like that. I don't really bother doing that. I'm like, this sucks. I think this is horrible. I don't think we should be doing this. And you know, so people know that I feel that way. And I think sometimes they're not really sure how to relate to that because I think they feel like the best thing to do is just figure out how to buck up and just make the best of the bad situation. But I do know that particularly teachers with kids who themselves have kids at home, who are trying to teach while their kids are doing something, I know they're in hell. And by and large, every teacher who's carrying a full load like I am, which is five classes plus an advisory, I think all of them are feeling like they're getting their ass kicked. And this is very hard. Beyond that, I don't know, because we have been scattered to the winds. We haven't really had a union meeting. I think at the very beginning of the year, we had a union meeting, and there hasn't been anything since. There's probably some internal reasons for that, but also, even if we did have one, we would have a lot of work to do to try to pull people together. I don't know how we would do it right now, to be honest.
Well, first of all, I'd like to tell our audience that they can always revisit some of the, I think, themes you were talking about, which is mental health, as well as what the workers are being programmed to do from our previous episodes, that they would like to go in depth as to what you were saying.
Yeah.
I think for me is just, I'm curious what penalties or punitive measures there are for teachers if you do something different. Like if you decided to meet up your students at Dolores Park. You right. understand? Like right. in a socially distanced
right.
way, met with 5 students at a time, yeah. you know, and not be socially hanging out with. I mean, excuse me, socially in close proximity rather than so that you can support those. I wonder what would happen if I, as of right now, I don't know any teacher, at least in my network, that is doing that.
No.
I imagine that it has come up where people have imagined it. But if you working for the government, essentially, you would you be penalized for it?
That hasn't come up, to be honest. It hasn't. I mean, and it hasn't been come. It hasn't come from parents. Hasn't come from students. And it hasn't really been hasn't been suggested by teachers. I think myself and another colleague, Darylin, once did as we thought about the idea of what a work action would actually look like. Mm-hmm. She kind of posed it, and I think it might be true that a work action under these conditions wouldn't be logging off. It would actually be all of us going to the school and bringing our students with us and running the school on our terms, not on the district's terms. So like but we're trying to figure it out right now. Cause I actually don't know what a work action looks like under these conditions. I will say, so I can't say that scenario has come up. I think if it did come up right now, I do think it would be treated like, oh my God, look at this dangerous person. The COVID's going to spike and stuff like that. And I think a person could be not just reprimanded, but could probably be fired. Because in the current environment of death and deadliness and all that kind of stuff that's being whipped up around COVID, I think you would be accused of risking the life of the student or the family members of that student. And for that reason, either suspended without pay or fired right off the bat. I could easily see that. The issues that have come up that have been more challenging in some ways is like, so I gave my phone number out to all my students and said, you know what, look, if we need to do office hours, just text me, da 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 da. So a week in, they pretty much said, well, look, you can't text students. Or if you do text a student, it has to have a counselor's name with it or an administrator, or it's got parent permission. And that's just really a challenging way of trying to communicate. I mean, we can email with them, text is by record. And I just found that very frustrating. Students have still texted me. Actually today I did end up texting a student who wanted to do office hours and I didn't include a name with it, but you know, I do think that has put a damper on even trying to connect through students through our phones and texting, trying to keep in touch with them. Cause that was one way that I tracked down my students in April and May, was by sending them texts. And I mean, there's ways I can do it, but they're putting all these barriers in the way unnecessarily. And mostly it's just covering their ass because they're concerned about legal stuff about, hey, you sent this thing to a student, but I'm sending emails to students and those things are records. So I don't really, it doesn't make any sense to me, except to administer over people's connections. And I feel like the idea of how we are connected with one another is increasingly being controlled, whether it's be through this data method and through this online internet method, or whether through it's the district or the administration. I feel like increasingly we are working and operating and socializing under conditions of, we will control your interactions with each other.
And what is the parent's response to all of this? A pulse? Do you feel a pulse? How does the expression?
I can't tell. Yeah, like a kid has a sense. I really can't tell.
Your finger on the pulse.
Yeah, I don't think I know what's happening with parents. Like one of the things I'm doing with my grades this year is I'm basically kind of doing it, particularly in my mainstream class, because I know how to communicate this in my mainstream and I don't know how to communicate in my EL classes. But I'm largely thinking I'm not going to give any student lower than a C. That's my one thing, is like, I don't know your situation. So how do I fail anybody under these circumstances? So that's the first thing I'm thinking. And the other thing I thought to do was I told the students in my mainstream class that they would create their own grading rubric. Like, tell me what a C work means for you, or B work, or A work. And then this marking period, I'm going to ask you to chime in on your grade. By and large, I'm probably going to end up giving them the grade that they give themselves.
Yeah, they'll give themselves A's.
They do. I mean, but in this regard, I am asking them to share that with their parent, and their parent will, you know, and if a parent has a problem with that, hopefully they'll communicate with me. But I have tried to communicate to them, I'd like this to not be something where I'm your opponent in this experience. I want to be your ally in something which I think is something we shouldn't be doing. So I want to be your a person you can count on to have your back here. And so I'm not interested in really using grades as a lever to get them to do something, because I don't believe they should be doing this. So how can I use grades as a lever to force them to do something that I don't believe they should be doing? If a parent tells me that they want me doing that with their student because they want to motivate them, I'm open to doing it. But I think a parent's going to have to tell me that.
Andy, the other one was, I have two more questions, if that's okay, Kenny, or Andy, was what has been, or we talked about at some, you were with SF Ready Strike, and what was the response when you gave A's to your students? I'm curious just to follow up with that. And if you plan to do that again for this school year.
I mean, we did all students deserve an A, and it definitely created a ripple in San Francisco. And that was part of that was a big, an initiative of Strike Ready SF. And I do think it helped push the district into basically credit, no credit posture last spring. And in fact, there's a woman who I met she has a business, you know, somewhere in Oakland. I can't remember where it was, but I was in her place, and she was telling me about, like, you know, we're not like those people in crazy San Francisco who gave all their students A's, you know. I was like, that was me, you know. She goes, what? She goes, yeah, you know, like, so obviously we did have an impact, and we made an impression, and this she's a parent, so she thought that was not the right thing to do. And I explained, look, this is why we did it. I think we ended up agreeing to disagree. But I think that did have an impact on people. And I think this year, though, the district and our administration is telling us, look, we're not doing that this year. This year, grades are back to being A, B, C, D, and F. And we, Strike Ready SF, has not really rediscussed that. And I've only talked with a few colleagues of mine. I talked with AJ about it. I talked with Darylin about it, and I think a little bit with Greg, about what I want to do with my grades. But I haven't really tried to kick off some sort of initiative around grades with other teachers. And I really am more looking for the moment when there's something that feels like there's something that brings us together. I'm not going to go ahead and try to pull people together around grades, because I don't know where people are at on that. And it's been really hard to get a sense of that. And Strike Ready SF, by and large, has mostly fallen apart and kind of, I would just say it's sort of dissolved for now. And I think a lot of those people will come back together if there's cuts that happen, but we haven't heard any cuts yet. But right now, Strike Ready SF isn't really doing anything.
And the other one was, do you know the numbers for the declining numbers? I was seeing something, I forget, and I was trying to look for it just even now, but the declining numbers of students, there was a students that showed up, and then students started declining their attendance in San Francisco, or at least in your school. Do you know any of those figures? Because there is a decrease of a student,
that definitely
especially
happened.
High school student.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely happened from April, May to March, April to May. You saw a decline last spring. I can't say I'm feeling that right now. I feel like attendance is low, like lower than it would normally be in a school year, but I don't sense a decline. I do sense already some burnout. And I'll have to see how that goes, like for students. And it's early in terms of this logging in stuff. But that's just my sense about it, that it's really hard to get students kind of pumped about doing things. And increasingly, it's hard to do that. So, but we'll see. I'm really early in saying that. But attendance right now has been low but stable. That's what I would describe it as. And again, mainstream numbers are not good, and EL numbers are really bad. Like 50% of our students are gone, or we don't.
And a follow-up to that, Tendi, how are they counting students' attendance? Because normally the traditional way is just you count students by what you physically see in their classroom.
I would see who shows up on Zoom, mark them present, and then if somebody sends me a text, if somebody sends me an email, if somebody tells me, hey, I got kicked off and da-da-da-da or whatever. I had a doctor's appointment, but I was going to be there. I mark them present. That's what we're told to do.
Because otherwise you lose funding if a student doesn't show up.
Yeah, I mean, and they're basically saying, look, they're trying to make themselves apparent to you. But it is I do think there's a financial incentive to doing that kind of thing, yes.
Yeah. That's it for me.
I mean, so here you are. A month into the school year, you have how many more months? Three, four.
I know that AJ told me she's been counting days. She's like literally marking days off, you know, like one at a time. We have 180 days we're supposed to teach. And I think she said, well, I got 160 something more. I was like, oh my God, that's horrible. Yeah. We got many more days.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious. I mean, I think a lot of us, even in our workplaces, I think we're just treading water, you know, and there is no sense as to what back to normal would mean. I mean, is there any sense that there is a plan for that, you know, to transition back or have you?
No, there's no talk of that. And I would say we're not treading water. We are sinking. We are, for the reasons we talked about, Eduardo mentioned in the previous episode that his colleagues or his friends from CCSF talked about. We are doing damage to children right now. We are doing damage to kids and their ability to socialize with each other, with adults. Like the idea that you log on and I might say hi or good morning and you just don't say anything. Like I get it. I'm not offended by that, but that is starting to become normalized. Like there's a distance that is becoming normalized. And we were worried about screens between us when we were meeting people. Right? All these kids with their phones on. Well, now look at the situation we're literally shoving them into a situation of
encouraging it.
And it's destructive. It's the opposite of safety. It is not safe at all. There's nothing healthy about it. It's destructive to institutions. It's destructive to individuals. It's destructive to communities. It's destructive to families. This is a sledgehammer we are putting to the notion of a community. And I wish I could call this treading water. I wish I could say we're just standing pat, because we're not. This feels very damaging. And it feels, like I said, I feel like it's damaging to me in terms of my mood and how I feel. And when I log off and I'm with Brandy and I have nothing to say, and she asked me how was work, and I don't want to talk about it. Even if it wasn't that bad, it's just, I don't want to talk about it. And we have to figure out other things to do. And I'm struggling to come up with a signal inside my brain, like to give myself like moments of like how I'm struggling to figure out how to reinvigorate myself. And we're 4 weeks in. So this is deadly. This is not safe. That's what I would say. And we unfortunately agreed to it under false notions of safety. And I don't even want to get into what I want to say about COVID and its threat to us, but we are feeling the effects of the damage being done by the ruling class on society, on education, on our students, and on workers. And I just feel like it's horrible. It's horribly damaging.
And what is your hope, you know, for this, what remains of the semester?
I hope. Yes, I hope that either students or parents or teachers, I forgot to talk about paraprofessionals because I am working with two paraprofessionals, and they're supposed to work in a classroom with students, and it's very difficult. You can't, and the best I can do is put them in a breakout room, but even there, they're looking at a blank screen, you know? So they're not getting to do that one-on-one with somebody. I really enjoy working with them, but it's not having that effect of helping students with individualized education plans, you know? And, you know, who have learning disabilities, it doesn't really help. It doesn't allow them to really play the role of assisting people with learning disabilities in a mainstream classroom. But what I hope is that either teachers or students or parents will decide we're not doing this anymore. We refuse to do distance learning, and we are going to come back, and we're going to make education be what we want it to be. And we do what we want, and we do what we want to do as it relates to education. When I say we, I mean parents, teachers, or parents, educators, and students. And I would say, yeah, take back our building, and you know, get the cafeteria running again. Again, the cops, I think, would shut it down. The city would shut it down. But that's one of the hopes I have, is that we just refuse to go along with this, and insist that we must be together in this experience of living and educating.
You should be the first school in the nation to do it, like in Occupy. Do it, attendee.
We would be the first strike that would say we insist on going back to work and working.
No, seriously, with parents and students and a few teachers, if you can get any, and go to the school and say, we will occupy this building. This building was for us, for you know, and we can figure out a way to make it work.
Right. Well, and maybe this does segue, and I think we possibly should. This segues into your experience, into what you're trying to do, because there are parents who I know who've asked me, what should I do with my kid? And I'm like, don't put them online. Go to a pod. You know, join something where you're going to have a social experience, because unless your school can guarantee you that your kid can be around other kids, I wouldn't do it. I mean, unless you're all worried about COVID, and a lot of these parents were saying, I'm not worried about it. I'm worried about what my kids are going through. So I tell them, I'm like, find something for yourself, because in my mind, I feel like we as educators have abandoned the goal, what we said we were standing for in public education. We've abandoned it by doing this. And so now it's every person for themselves. So go find a pod so your kid can have other kids to be around.
I wish you were that graceful and nice when I first shared with you what I was doing.
Look, do you want me to say something about that or no?
Let Kenny first, and then you can say whatever you want. I want Kenny to attack me this time.
I mean, that's kind of the, you know, why we wanted to first start with you, you know, and sharing like what's happening in public education, the difficulties. I mean, as a teacher, because I mean, I think there is another perspective, parents, you know, who are, I mean, you did mention teacher parents, you know, like in the hell they're going through. And, you know, I think working class parents overall are having to jump through loopholes in order to, for their kids to get this, whatever it's called, education. So I guess the question is, you know, what kind of alternatives there are, because as you just mentioned, this conversation about pods, educational pods, has become something more prevalent, I think, in the news. And I first became aware through you too. Like, I don't know what a pod is. Maybe if we can start with that, like maybe defining what a educational pod is.
I'll just read basic standard definition, that way we don't. Learning pods are also called pandemic pods or micro schools or nano schools. They're basically a small group of students, typically 3 to about 10 children, who learn together outside of the classroom but still in person. And some pods are hiring tutors to teach a child school curriculum. Other pods are sharing teaching duties amongst parents. And other families are opting out of their kids' school entirely, mm-hmm. and treating a pod like a homeschooling co-op with an agreed-upon curriculum. I'm doing more of a hybrid, which is the sort of pod that is in a co-op sharing teacher duties amongst a group of families. We're four educators. So that's basically what a learning pod is, Kenny. And they became, there was Google traffic went up the wahoo when in August, because in July, más o menos, yes, in San Francisco, there were people beginning talking about it, and then it just caught like wildfire. No, is that a pun? No, that's not a pun. That's not a pun. That's not. But that's a reference to what is the wildfires. I should just quickly say, San Francisco woke up to being on Mars this morning. for the orange skies because of all the fires around the Bay Area. And I hope everyone is safe. So that is what a pandemic pod is, and they're set up by families, and now they're just gaining traction all over the USA, and even in Mexico, at least from my network, I know some people are now beginning to do some of them. In Europe, I'm sure, I just haven't really asked around, but I'm sure it's happening as well there. Those are mostly well, I know in Mexico people that are doing it. So yeah, that's I guess what you can ask me from there. Why did I do it? Or
I mean, I do want to clarify. I mean, maybe give us a little context as to what you do, you know, in the educational field.
Well, currently I am teaching kinder, but not in a formal setting like Andy in a school district. I'm in this learning pod and I sub or take on other responsibilities. I'm utilized with my small group. We have a small group of about three children. We're trying to add a fourth. I'll tell you why later. And I really wanted five children and more. As much, it's like the Titanic, you know, with all this pandemic and the fires. I just really, this little lifeboat, I felt like we had so much space. You know how in the beginning all the wealthy families were in these lifeboats with a bunch of space in between? I feel like that's what we're doing. Yeah. And we need to put as many. But so I wanted to put as many disadvantaged kids and families in our learning pod. So we're trying with a fourth. And I really wanted a fifth, but.
So just going back to the learning pod, the one that you're doing, so you're getting paid to do this?
No.
Okay.
I'm co-raising my nephew. So one thing that my brother and his partner and I are doing, we want, as a family, we decided what we didn't want for my nephew was to be in the school system early on, to be sort of taught how to behave and how to just the standard way of teaching wasn't going to be something we wanted as a family for him to be taught. And so we were also anti-technology by choice, not because we didn't have the resources, but because we just by choice. There are those that have lots of technology and those that are just poor, don't have access, or only have it through their phones. And then there are the very small in the minority of us who just say, like, this is not natural. Kids should not be on tech, should not know how to work screens, and shouldn't be watching films, or kids shouldn't just be pushed in front of a television screen watching Disney films all day and learning Elsa songs from Frozen. Over the summer, we were sort of trying to figure out what do we do for the socialization part, because he's doing well academically, but how do we try to have him learn? He is also an only child, so how do we have him learn just how to be around other kids? I mean, you have to learn that. That's basic. That's just basic things you have to learn. No? And when he does go to school, he should know how to engage with other students. So the idea popped in my head about possibly creating a learning bubble. When they started talking about social bubbles in Berkeley, and you could have them up to 6 or 12. And there was like a rush of people trying to make clicks, I think, at that time. I think it was June or July, I forget. And then I had a teacher friend of mine that we worked together, a former colleague from the same school, that we worked together, and she had also had the same idea. And we joined forces, and we decided, since our kids were the same age, that we would do this together. And then we decided to have another friend of ours in our network, who is also a teacher slash librarian, and the father of their child, and so we decided to have we teamed up. So we're basically four educators already, having had the experience to be able to do this. I think my friend and I, the first my first friend and I that we decided to do this with, we have more of the elementary school level kinder experience. So we really looked for ways to utilize the knowledge that we had to be able to make it work for the kids when we would have this learning path.
From what I hear, it sounds like these groups, small groups, learning groups, spring up from this notion that socializing is important, and being in physical proximity, it's, an important aspect beyond just the information part. Like you said, you've been in public education, in private education. Who are the people accessing these pods,
Yeah.
Because I haven't heard of it before.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, I was listening to, before I came on to the episode with you both, I was listening to KQED interviewing families from different backgrounds. I was listening to NPR, as well as I was listening to other smaller podcasts that were just talking about the access to the kind of people that have the resources to even initiate learning pods or pandemic pods like these. Mostly, I think families that have the network, that have, like, for example, us, the four of us have experience in education. The four of us knew each other through the same sort of community of educators. We all have houses. We literally all have backyards. We don't have to worry about rent as much as some of the most struggling families. I have to acknowledge some of these privileges, no? We have the flexibility because we can work from home. These are sort of the things I know are uncomfortable to talk about, because I don't want to say these things, but I do say them because they allow for what we have created. And when I have heard interviews of other families, they're not aware that they can even create some of, they don't even know if homeschooling is legal. They don't even, I mean, just even the basic notion that they could potentially teach their kids is sometimes, there isn't that idea that they could. Most parents delegate those activities to someone else outside of their home. And that's mostly how we have functioned as a society. Whereas in former communities, in communes, everyone in a village, literally, not just because Hillary Clinton co-opted that word, but really because, there is an African proverb that says, it takes a village to raise a child. Everyone, in Mexico, your tías and your tíos and your primos, you have that community. And here, as a Mexican, I don't have, my nephew doesn't have those primos and primas here. They don't have, so I connect it with other folks that I can. And some families cannot do that. Imagine you coming as an immigrant and you have your family back home. You don't, who do you connect with? So mostly these are most established families who have the economic freedom to be able to engage in activities outside of survival mode, to be able to connect with other families to raise their kids, or go over to their neighbor's house, or, my friend just lives 5 minutes away. I could just walk over there and drop off my nephew. And we live in a relatively safe neighborhood. I don't ever put a lock on mine. But, I know what that sometimes the criticism is that it's going to really exasperate or widen the gap between those that have and have not. And I have gotten into really strong, not the first one was with Andy who went after me, and then another friend of mine who said it was an insult to education, who feel as if we're just exasperating the inequalities.
It's very interesting, the metaphor they used earlier about Titanic, you know, this sinking ship. And basically, it sounds to me like it's, you used that word, like, you know, it's people running to the rafts, you know, and trying to save themselves. You know, everyone is being divided in a situation of emergency. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I just, makes me wonder, you know, where I would be. Because at one point I was an immigrant here who came, you know, and was living in a house with six other, in a room with six other people. You know, I can't even imagine a pod, you know, and people that may have circumstances where they don't want to make noise, you know, make trouble with their landlords. And, you know, it's more of a commentary, I guess, and in that it makes sense, you know, that people are, and obviously the people that have the most, the quickest ability to get to the raft will get there. And sadly, I don't think everyone's going to be, you know, on those rafts. I think we know people that are drowning, literally drowning. And, you know, it's these inequities that we're talking about, you know, I don't know. I just don't see it so much as being a problem of the people getting to the rafts as to why the hell the ship is sinking. Yeah. And it seems to me that I think Lipson, I don't know, like, but the ship is sinking on purpose, you know, in, yeah. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Well, I know one family literally in, that does leave their child, who is just 10 years old at home all day, 'cause they have to go to work. She is a single mother and she has to work. She works in a, you know, as an essential worker. I'm quoting that because I think that that's a nice way to just say that we appreciate these workers and we really mistreat them. But they leave their child who's 10 and trust that they're going to be online. And you know, you have access to so much information online when you're just at the fingertips, you can just go on, and they don't have access to a learning pod, or they don't have access to time to teach their kid. But all of the families that I see on the Zoom, you know, the little cuadraditos, I see them, and sometimes the kids are just left on this couch, and the kids just, you know, they're five and they can't concentrate, and the mother's working in the background, and you see the grandma sitting there because she's being assigned to like make him pay attention or something, and pon atención, you know, and their Central American accent, and then the kids, like, you know, bored out of his mind, because it's 2 hours and 30 minutes long learning on the screen. I don't know. It breaks my heart every time I look at those Zoom. And the more I stopped, because it just, they're not getting it. There are a few. I know that few, but again, that's only those who are not falling through the cracks. Andy, go ahead, or Kenny. Yeah.
I still feel like we haven't really described what your pod does. Where is school? What's lunch? How do you decide your curriculum? How do you work? How does it work? You know?
All right. Yeah. So I see. You want to know some of the logistical or fundamentals too. Yeah. I thought you meant like I have it. Have every parent has a house and a yard where the children for that day. I'm on Mondays, and the other parent is on Tuesdays, and another parent is on Wednesday, and another parent is on Thursday. And I make myself available to some.
And no school on Friday?
No
school on Friday then?
No school on Friday.
There you go.
Yeah. There are just three kids. And we all work from home. And it's 4 to 5 hours a day. It's supposed to be 4, but sometimes if the kids want or the parents want to, it could be extended. Also, we have relationships with friends, so the kids hang out outside of this. We talk on many weekly meetings to discuss what the kids should learn, what worked, what did not work. We each have educational goals for the kids. What else? We have lunch at home. Each child brings their food. We also have very strict COVID-19 protocols. I have to wear a mask that's transparent. I bought one so that the kids can read my lips if they need to phonetically. The kids are learning sounds. My classroom is in here. You know, this is the classroom where I have their learning goals on posters. I just, back here, I have a bunch of stuff with names. We also don't do certain things like benching, which is something that the kids do a lot in elementary school. It's an intentional community. We learn about consent. We learn about political things if we have to. For example, we don't just talk about Martin Luther King like some holiday. We really do talk about the radicalist that he was. I focus mostly on gardening and food security, and so I teach the kids how to grow food. So that's from an hour in the afternoon, and they have their lunch in the morning. The kids wash their hands constantly. They don't have to wear masks because they're kids, but the adults do have to wear it. There's only supposed to be one adult in the classroom, so to speak, and any adult that comes has to have a mask on. Wash their hands, follow protocols, and the educator of the day is the one who leads any sort of how the activity should be done. There's dance, there's art, there's gardening, there is learning mathematics through all of these mediums, and reading and writing through creative expression. And we just the other day had here in my yard, I took out a big pool for a sunny day because it was hot over the weekend, and I splashed the children. I have hot water running and cold water, and the beauty of my garden is that all that water is reused, so I don't feel bad about it for my plants. And the children, I have them use Dr. Bonner soap for everything, and hand sanitize them, their hands. We talk about our feelings. I do an emotional how do you feel sort of curriculum, and it's all in Spanish. Everything is in Spanish. That's what we do. It's child-led. The child sort of determines. For me, it's sort of organic. It's not very strict. Everything is about, like, for me, it's very important for the children to feel safe and to feel they have a very fun learning experience, because they don't want to carry that, oh, I hate going to school kind of thing. So the children really learn at their pace, and no one is behind, no one is advanced. Everyone learns at different paces, and they compensate for different things socially and academically. But I would say, at least I'm very, very focused on more the socialization, the social-emotional part, especially because it is a stressful time to be indoors a lot. And they have at least in my house, I have the biggest yard. They have the entire yard to run. And they have bikes and all kinds of stuff out there. And they make a lot of noise. There isn't any need for being quiet. Mm-hmm. And my neighbors know. They like to watch the children run and play, mostly the older neighbors. I reduce the amount of negations that are being said to them. For example, I don't tell them, don't run. I tell them, walk instead, right? Like, that's sort of the difference in the way that I teach them, because I don't want them to feel as if they're being constantly scolded, like in school. You know, you have that.
Yeah.
And in Spanish, yeah.
It almost sounds like a community. Sorry. Yeah.
Do you try to make Monday, then go to Tuesday, then go to Wednesday, then to Thursday? Or is it more like as you work together with the other teachers, you're kind of like, I'll do my thing Monday. It might be connected to Tuesday. Is that a concern or not when you constructed this?
Well, you're talking about curriculum.
Yeah. Like how, as the, as, Does a student's day on Monday have to be connected to their student day on Tuesday?
It can, but it doesn't have to be. Each of us have something very special to contribute. One of the educators loves dance. The other educator does cooking, baking. Another educator, I forget what she's doing with the learning pod, and I'm focused. So it can be connected. So for example, if I'm growing food, some of that food could be then used for the cooking, a long project. So it's all in a way that the project is being connected to the following day. So yes, they can be, but it doesn't have to strictly necessarily be that way.
How would you describe your own experience of this? It sounds like you like doing this. And secondly, how would you describe the students' experience of this? Like, I obviously described mine in distance learning and my sense of what's going on there.
Yeah.
Could you say more about,
I'm carrying a lot of guilt, honestly, because the children are just blossoming. They're having such a wonderful time. They're building their relationships. They are they're strengthening their bond. They each have something to contribute. I also expose them to French and ASL, American Sign Language, ASL. And one of the children heard me speak to my nephew in French, and the child asked me, "What is that?" And is learning French now, is with me, little words here and there. And I sing the songs in Spanish from José Luis Orozco, which is a very popular Mexican artist. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is my experience is I carry guilt. That's the first thing, because I know that there is some kid somewhere out there that's not getting that, you know? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I guess as when I'm not feeling guilty is I feel that this experience a lot different and more in tune to what I would like to see in schools, because the schools that I worked in or worked in privately, I just remember many times when I was working in the UK with a family, they had a very strict structure of what they wanted me to teach. So I had to teach Spanish, mathematics, English, science, and it was very, they had a very specific thing they how they wanted me to do, and it was basically academic for their kids. When I was in Mexico, it was just mostly English. I had to teach it in a very specific way. When I was teaching as well here in the USA with private families, it was very structured. They wanted to, and I did not like it. In the school district as well, you know, there's just standardized testing, preparing students for how to be not children, rather, but how to be workers. They are trained to be in classrooms, and you have to learn in a standard way. So you have to raise your hand. You cannot call out, right? You have to sit in a circle, and you have to do show and tell, performing your speaking skills to show more confidence. You have to, in this elementary, you're different, you're in high school, right? And in elementary school, you have to learn how to sit in a straight line sit up and stand in a straight line. You have a schedule for everything, and you're mostly graded on how your academic work is meeting a certain educational goal. This is different in the sense that there isn't any of that necessarily followed strictly. There is the educational goals, but we recognize that the kids' love of learning is a higher priority for us than it is to meet a certain educational goal. And we love that our group or our community isn't judgy if one kid is falling behind, because there is no falling behind, and that's something that exists in schools.
Yeah.
Our kids don't fall behind. Our kids have different abilities, and so we explore those abilities and we sort of encourage that growth, and that is a different model from how school is. So that's my experience, and that I love this model more than I love what I was doing back then, which I never sat any kid on the bench really, but mostly raise your hand, sit on the bench sort of ways. Really did not, this is why I left, and I didn't want to be a teacher.
But in addition to feeling guilty, it sounds very fulfilling in terms of your own values as an educator.
Yes, that's why when I'm not feeling guilty, when this is definitely more of what I would like to do than what I did and previously in schools, in the school district.
So you work with young kids. How would you imagine this works different with maybe kids of, you know, high school age?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did foster a kid that was older and was already in fifth grade, and I had him until he was in high school. I think it depends on what you're trying to do, right? If you're trying to have, or what at that time, because I also, this is a lot of questioning with adolescents, you have to do, it's less about what you provide, it's more about you ask with them. So I would homeschool instead, because to me, the academic work seems to, I'm not sure about you, Andy, but there are a lot of high school teachers that are giving a lot of academic work to supplement their time outside of the Zoom, if they're not going to be on Zoom calls, because they say they know some students are not on Zoom calls. So they give them a lot of homework packets, a lot of school assignment packets. And I think that I would be opposed to that way of doing it, because mathematics and even some of the three-dimensional experiences to learn some of this stuff isn't through a screen. And I would do a sort of cohort, like a learning pod, but I also would possibly maybe just get out of the school district altogether.
I mean, I don't know, but isn't that the goal, you know, to replicate this in a massive way, you know, to have pods at school for kids, you know, like a better ratio of teacher to student?
You mean like what sometimes reformers try to do, where they try to lower the amount of students in their classrooms? I think ideally teachers would like to do that. I don't know if the state will allow it, because that would mean more educators. Yeah. Imagine if Andy can have 25 students to 30 students in one class, why would they hire more teachers to have just 10 students where they can have that personal? I don't know if that's going to ever happen.
Not under capitalism.
not under capitalism. And also under the kind of system, we did an episode here and what's left on the sort of education, our thoughts or reflections or our ideas on education. I think that the sort of education that I envision for our kids is one that acknowledges the different facets or aspects of a human being that isn't academically driven. What is the goal of education, I think, is the question we should ask ourselves. Is it to train ourselves to be workers, or should we train students to love learning, but what kind of learning that is, you know? And I think that the goal should be that students sort of explore what they're interested in, and from there take charge of their education rather than adults taking charge of their education. Right. And democratically make decisions about stuff. I think sometimes young people are undermined, or they're thought of very stupid and ignorant. And I think that that's part of the reason why sometimes we have issues the way that we have, because students don't feel like they're a part of society and they don't feel like they are valued. And they are human beings, especially some of the kids that Andy has, have very strong opinions about a lot of things. But I think sometimes when you're sidelined to the, you know, you're put to the side, then you do other things because you don't have, you're not valued as a person, you know? So I would do it differently. And the learning part of the homeschooling idea that I would do, it would be mostly students led, with less of me involved and more of them being teachers for themselves, something I cannot do with these kids. But it would be more of a model where I'm just there to sort of support and mediate, but they would then take charge of their education and force them to think what projects will they do for themselves. This is a sort of model I tried to create with Saul, who I fostered in the UK with other adolescents his age when I was, we were in a farm, and there were many, I was trying to have them do this very model. But again, I think that you'd have to really take away a lot of that system. You can't just be in the system and do it. And you'd have to tear down the system entirely, this capitalist system, because after this, where would they go for work?
You'd have to get rid of private property. Literally destroy capitalism, you know, pillars.
I think largely the reason why kids don't go to school is because there isn't, to them, they don't see how the school is there for them, or they're not treated as equals. And I think students are very smart, and they can take, very, very intelligent. They know what they want, and they know exactly what's happening in the communities and what they need for themselves. You know?
I mean, your friend from City College said something about how Black students had found their sense of self-worth grow as a result of being out of school, right? Particularly out of our public education system. That, you know, like you said, like you described at the elementary school, it's at all levels. It's attempting to control you and direct you into a funnel, and make you become something for someone else. And the thing you're describing is, I think, closer to the vision of what educators should be fighting for, which is education that is directed from educators, from students. There are examples like this in the Russian Revolution, after the revolution, where there were schools that did try to do things like this, where students would direct, particularly at the higher levels, at the middle school and high school levels, where they were much more self-directed, self-directed in terms of their own educational experience. So in that regard, Eduardo, guilt aside, does any part of you see what you're doing as, because I think there are people who might see this pod growing, these growing pods, as part of a way of transforming education in that direction. Do you see it that way? Because what you are doing is what educators should be doing. Do you see this as this kind of pod experience as prefigurative to a way of transforming education?
Yes, a little challenging with younger kids, but I can see it. I think if educators took back education for themselves and with their students, and mathematics is important. I really do think that physics and mathematics are important subjects. But when you are in a pandemic, when you are afraid of getting shot by the police, when you are going through tough times trying to survive, those things I think should be put to the side for the moment. And you should work with teachers to overtake, as I was saying, maybe, you know, we were talking earlier about how taking back a public school, I think students could potentially it almost seems like a form of strike, right? Student strike, where students would opt out and say, this isn't working for me. And they would then organize with educators. And when I say educators, I don't just mean classroom teachers. I mean the teacher assistants, the cafeteria workers, because they are educators too, in my eyes. Mm-hmm. And if principals truly feel that they are with their students, then even them, but they would have to demonstrate it. They would have to go onto the streets as well with their students. And I think take back education, what belongs to us. And they would then, so these learning pods would be almost working groups. You understand? Like they wouldn't, so that's how I see it with adolescents more so, mm-hmm. where these would be working groups, caucuses, you know, I mean, they could potentially be areas of organizing. And that would be the education, I think. That's why I was saying, what is the goal? I mean, what is your intent or educational? It depends on what your educational goals. If I had an older kid, I would really say the goal right now is not the Shakespeare that I love reading. Right now is the goal to organize. And we, you know, how do you feel being here? Cooped up at home, isolated, being told you have to now make all kinds of various user accounts. This is the moment where you then, you know, as parents and families, we say, you know what? Okay, fine. We'll organize with, you know, if I was a parent, I'd say, Andy, you know what? My kid in your class isn't learning. And I'm going to get out. But you know what? I don't just want to get out and leave you behind with those students. I'm actually going to say, if you want, here's my contact information. Let's talk about how we can create, just form this learning pod to an organizing group where you and I can then contact other families if they don't like this either. And so they're not just going to be learning pods. You understand? I think for me, the kids, the smaller kids, I think it would be challenging, right? Because they're, you know, there's that part. But there's ways. I mean, I could potentially think of ways. Like when we had talked to Allison McDowell, I was ready to be part of the parents group at my nephew's PTA and say, "What? Look what they are doing to our kids." But again, I've been shut out from that because we're all in these square screens,
yeah,
or rectangle. But so I think it could be transformative. This is a learning pods actually could be turned to some to create fruition a different way. I think that that's the reason why co-ops have existed way before this whole pandemic. Co-ops have been run mostly by parents and families that said, you know what, that teacher didn't actually, that school didn't do anything for my child. I meant to say school, I said teacher. And the school's actually making my child feel like this isn't, you know, because teachers get overwhelmed. There's a lot of things that happen in schools. And they decide for themselves, I'm going to organize with other parents to create a co-op. Maybe these co-ops can be more than just co-ops for your kids. Maybe we can think of a larger picture, which is what I'd like to do.
But. Kenny, what are your thoughts after hearing both these things?
Man, honestly, you both have, you gave me the shitty part, Lipson. Eduardo, you like, you're giving me things that, you know, are adding to my sense of revolution and possibilities of, you know, a new society, you know, and, you know, asking questions as to what education is and what it should look like, what a new world could look like, me as a parent, you know, what I would want. I haven't thought about all these things, you know, and I do want to have kids someday. Even within the organizing, you know, there are families, and I think we'll talk off camera, but that are struggling and that they have kids, you know, your nephew's age, and they're struggling with childcare because at a fundamental level, you know, that's what school is, I think, for many parents, working parents, childcare. So they can go off and, you know, earn their living, subsistence.
Yeah. Sorry.
But if, you know, Kenny, and that is the problem with schools, because even though teachers don't say it's child care, there's a larger system that makes it seem like that, because that's where we put our kids in and we separate so that the parents can go to work. And then we make these divisions between work and school where these people take care of my kids, where we should actually be, you know, working together, parents and teachers should be working together. That's the problem with why parents, I know many of that because I worked in a largely 90% of the population of my school was Latino, from Argentina, from Honduras, from Guatemala, from Venezuela, and from Mexico, and they sometimes they were trained to think that the teacher is the leader, the know-it-all, and here are my kids. And then they separate themselves, their lives from school, as if there is no class action that could be taken there. There is no unity there. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is what the intention of schools are at the larger level, mm-hmm. is that you're supposed to be leaving it up to the teachers and you go work. And this is basically, we're not calling it this way, but this is childcare, you know?
Like that's part of why I am a socialist, that I don't disconnect this, for example, from private property. That, you know, if you have to struggle to pay rent, you know, that school, then it functions as that, you know, in that cycle, vicious cycle of keeping you trapped So in order to change that and give this possibilities of a world that you're describing, you know, as a society, it, you know, we have to eliminate things like private property and profit, you know, out of the equation. And so there is no other way. Otherwise, everyone's running for the raft, you know, to save themselves.
Yeah. And
I would
go ahead, Marta.
I would really like to see schools be a place, just like there are shelters doing emergencies. Well, right now, we are through emergencies, right? We're in a class struggle. This is the moment for the schools to open up as emergency shelter in places. Not like shelter in place, but shelter like places where organizing work can take place with parents and teachers together. I think that is a working table, right? There, schools should be. And the community should be a part of that as well. I think sometimes we... which works perfectly for the ruling class. No, we separate. This is the educational field. This is where I work. These are the neighbors. I live here. We sort of don't see how they're interconnected. And if we actually said the school is here, your neighbors are involved, everyone, I think that it would be something would shift in the way that people think. But that is not, I think, that people are conditioned to think.
Yeah. And I mean, I really feel like this convinces me again, more that public education must be dismantled, and it is being dismantled, but it's being dismantled on terms decided by the capitalists, and it's creating a situation where some people are going to try to abandon ship and do some of the things that you're trying to do, Eduardo, and try to experiment with some things, but the ship is still moving society where things are going, and you're nephew is going to get caught in this game one way, shape, or form. They're going to catch your nephew in the game of remote something or another, of online something or another, on data collection something or another, on biometrics something or another. But I do believe that what you're doing there does speak to what all of us should be doing. We need to dismantle public education. We need to tear it apart, and as part of tearing apart the way society is constructed and structured right now, and reform it in a completely different way. So unfortunately, public education is, as we know it, is being transformed and destroyed in one way, but turned into even a more dangerous thing for children and for workers. And the only alternative is to destroy the whole thing and build it on our own terms. And this is where I do feel like it's actually been really useful for me to hear about your POD experience, because I understand you feel guilt, but I actually think what you're doing in the POD is a reaffirmation of what all of us should be doing in the world.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you're a revolutionary, Eduardo.
Yeah.
Me?
Yeah, I think that what you're doing is revolutionary.
Andy is revolutionary. And you know what, Kenny, it's interesting. Andy and I were talking, and I said, I think Kenny would like to ask me some questions about where I stand and maybe why I'm not a socialist. I don't know if you both would say I'm revolutionary. I don't actually use that word, but I would be down for the cause, but I think I have a different approach from both of you, how we see it. And maybe we'll discuss that at a different time. But even though I do not use the word revolutionary, I personally know that, what is Gemma's word? When push comes to shove, she always uses this term. I will be there. Yeah. That's why I don't have kids.
Yeah, but I just feel like what you're doing.
Yeah.
No, pods are not some abandoned ship, and the ship will be recreated. The pods will be collected unless the capitalists are taken on. But I do believe the actual spirit of what you all are doing is in the spirit of what all of us workers should be trying to do, which is dismantle our workplaces and reform them under our ownership.
Yeah. Yes. I was waiting for some criticisms at some point. I guess they're not coming.
I mean, look,
Andy,
I'd be sending him to your school. That's the bottom line. If I didn't, I'd be irresponsible. It would be like if I couldn't do it, then I couldn't do it. If I didn't know it didn't exist, then I wouldn't do it. But I would not be putting my kids through this distance learning hell right now. I actually told one parent that who was thinking of actually traveling around the country for a year, I was like, do that, not going to mission or whatever, being online, going to mission.
I would say also that part of this goal of capitalism is to disarm parents from feeling that they can educate their kids. People would say, well, what about this whole pandemic? Well, even then, with the online resources, it's still delegated to educators to take care of it, no? But just talking to parents who haven't done this before, the basic things, there was a mother, because I was talking to a mother, she was struggling. I say pre-literate, I don't say illiterate. There's a difference. Illiterate means people who don't know how to read, and pre-literate means there's a potential to read. There was a pre-literate mother who said to me once, she said to me, I don't know how to read. She's an immigrant from, I think, from Central America. And she said, I don't know how to read. How do I teach? Maestro, ¿cómo le enseño a mi hijo a leer? How do I teach my child how to read? And I said, how old is your child? And he said, 6 or 7. 6, I think it was. And I said, your child doesn't know you don't know how to read. You just get a book. You look at the pictures. And you narrate the story. You don't have to know the words. You just narrate the story. That already is reading out loud. And the mother was like, oh, I didn't realize. I said, yes. You see, sometimes parents feel so incapable because they're disregarded as educators for their own kids. And what a learning pod, I think, can do is take back that I'm also a teacher, just like Andy is a teacher. Andy is a different teacher, but I'm also a teacher. And sometimes parents don't have that confidence in themselves. They're insecure of who they are to their kids. And for me, it's very important to arm them back and say, you have to say, this is what I want. Be an advocate for your kid. You have to say, what's not working? And kids lose their self-confidence in schools because, you know, they're falling behind or whatever. And then parents feel guilty because it's a reflection on them. But they also are disarmed. And so the cycle continues. So, and teachers don't have the time to be able to. So what I guess I'm trying to say is that these learning pods are also available for people who want to in the community to say, like before, we are in a village. My tia's on Wednesdays, and you know, my neighbor's on Tuesdays, and the kids get together, and we know these people. They're not just random people, of course, right? It's a safe space, and people would organize with maybe a local teacher that could come and support a family or village or whatever, and it would be less about what the state dictates what education should be, trying to meet what corporate interests or corporations are trying to shove into curriculum that they're trying to learn, or learning false curriculum about slavery or Native Americans, or putting up rosy pictures of certain presidents. You see, the thing is, I think that is what we could do during this time almost, as I'm speaking, I'm thinking out loud with you both. But no, seriously, I think that families, working class families, should, this is the moment for them, you know? The other thing too, if there is a learning pod, any family, anyone who is listening to this and are having learning pods, I would say please invite one family, at least one kid that may be in your community or needs in their social group, in your social network group, just put out like there is a learning pod for a kid that needs to have sort of a safety net. We, as a collective, we came to an agreement that we would invite another family, and a family that we knew could use this. And we're working through that now. There are differences and difficulties right now through the other family because of time, space, differences in culture. I think that what we're trying, what I'm hoping other learning pods can do is like recruit those that don't have the time, the economic freedom, the resources, you know, that's what we're trying to do with One Family. You don't have to teach. You don't have to worry about the housing. You don't have to worry about this. It's free. Don't worry about it. Just bring your child, follow the safety protocols. We'll make it work somehow. And really that invitation for other families is sort of allowing them also to be into a network where maybe they wouldn't have otherwise been in one. You know, that's all. I think I'll leave it at that.
Pods are not the answer to this, to what's taking place, but maintaining public education as it is definitely not the answer. And I do think this dismantling, it's being dismantled anyway. And I think it needs to be taken back by workers. And so I actually do believe, like I said, that this, that the thing you're describing, should speak to what all people who care about education and society should be attempting to try to do collectively. If a parent told me that they wanted to get out, I would first say, can we talk to some of the other parents who are in my class and can we organize them? So that maybe be the only thing that it's a numbers question of how do we get more people involved in the process. So, but I think the process you're describing is the right one.
I know I said the last thing, but you know, the thing that parents also need to get over is, do you want to add this or not? Is just to know that COVID-19 is one of those barriers that they're really trying to scare people to not organize. And yeah. So in order for, even I'm struggling with my learning pod, just to try to get them to understand, they're activists, like one. And that I think that there has to be the organizing effort, but how do you get over the COVID conversation is what I'm trying to say, Candy.
I would say that the most afraid of COVID are the most educated people often.
Yeah. I think you're right, Kenny. I think you're right. And I'm saying that a lot.
Quote unquote.
Yep.
Okay. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast slash channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes wherever you found this episode or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast slash channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms. And turn on your notifications, please, so that we could show up on your feed and not miss out on any of these episodes. Where you can find us is on Spotify, iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you have heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Abarca with co-hosts Kenny Cepeda and Andy Lipson. Ciao.
Bye-bye.